This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Library Science Channel on New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm joined by Nina Lager-Vestberg, author of Picture Research, the work of intermediation from pre-photography to post-digitization. Picture Research was published by MIT Press in June 2023 and is available open access. Picture Research focuses on how pictures were saved, stored, and searched in a time before scanners, servers, and search engines, and describes the dramatic difference it made when images became scannable, searchable, and distributable via the internet. While the camera, the darkroom, and the printed page are well-known sites of photographic production that have been replaced by cell phones, imaging software, and websites, the cultural intermediaries of mass circulation photography, picture librarians and researchers, editors and archivists, are less familiar. Drawing on documents and representations across a range of cultural expressions, Picture Research reveals the intermediation that has been performed by skilled workers in a variety of roles, making use of pre-photographic, photographic, and digital machineries of capture, accumulation, extraction, and transmission. Nina Lager-Vestberg is professor of visual culture at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Nina, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get started talking about your book, I would love if you could share a little bit with listeners about your background, where you grew up and went to university, and what brought you to your research in photography and photo libraries.
Yeah. Okay. So I grew up in Oslo, Norway. And I went to the UK, to London more specifically, to do a bachelor degree in film, video and photographic arts at the University of Westminster. And at that time, I thought I was going to be a photographer, but I realized during that time that that really wasn't for me. And then I decided instead that I wanted to try for a career as a picture editor, or a photo editor, I think you'd say, in North America. And I did some internships at a picture library and a magazine. And then, cutting a long story short, eventually got a permanent job on the picture desk of a Sunday newspaper in London. And then after a couple of years working there, I sort of felt that I wasn't quite done studying after all. And I sort of ended up doing an MA degree in history of art at Birkbeck College at the University of London. And I was doing that part-time in the evenings while I was working full-time as a picture researcher. And then I was made redundant two-thirds of the way through my course then. And I was then rehired by the company that my job had been outsourced to. As we may get onto later, I have a sort of a personal experience of the labor conditions in the picture research industry as well. And then when I was, I really got into my MA and I decided that I really wanted to be an academic. And so I went then on to get a fully funded grant to do a PhD at the same college and with the same supervisor. And while I was doing my PhD, I also carried on freelancing on the picture desk of another newspaper about one day a week for the first sort of 18 months of my PhD. And then when my grant ran out, as it tends to do before you finished, I went back there as a regular freelancer for a few days a week while I was finishing my thesis and starting to look for postdoctoral positions. And I guess throughout this period, I've been thinking about how the work I was doing as a picture researcher had changed, because of how digital search and delivery services had been adopted since I started. I started doing it in the late 90s, and then when I was getting towards sort of like, yeah, I guess 2005, I was getting back into it, and it had changed a lot in the meantime. And basically, I'm one of those people who just thinks a lot about how work is being done, not just about what to do. And so in the period after I submitted my thesis and I was waiting to defend it, I happened to watch the television drama Shooting the Past, directed by Michael Polyakov, and which first came out in 1999, but hadn't seen it then. And it's set in an old-fashioned picture library. I mean, old-fashioned even by the 90s standard. And when I was watching it, I had a bit of an epiphany, I think. It sort of served as a kind of catalyst for me to start thinking about the work of picture librarians who depicted in the show, but also myself as a picture researcher, as a potential research object. I guess it gave me a sort of distance. It gave me a lens to see my own work through in a way. And it also was a way of making that day job that I was doing as a picture researcher feel more relevant to the academic research career that I eventually wanted to have. And so I designed a research project about the impact of digitization on photo libraries and archives. And I applied for a postdoctoral fellowship from the J. Paul Getty Foundation, who generally awarded me a grant. And that was mainly to carry out a sort of oral history project and interviews with various professionals in the business about how they saw their work before and after digitization. So that was a kind of kernel that started off the project that ended up in the book.
Yeah, amazing. And so then I guess that leads us to talk more about the book, which digs into the work of intermediation between producers and consumers of pictures and shows how that's changed over time. So you clearly have this like personal interest in writing this book about the human side of photo archiving, but what were some of the other things that led you to this book, and what were your goals for this book?
Well, I guess my initial goal, you know, inspired by this experience of watching Shooting the Past, was to kind of document and celebrate, in a way, a class of cultural workers whose really invisible work of intermediation was essential to the way visual culture in Europe and the US, or North America, developed in the 20th century. And in particular, the specific skills that this work required and that you developed by doing this work. And I had this experience. I had published an article, sort of early article from this project in 2008. And I got a phone call from a picture librarian who just had to tell me that this was the first time they'd read an academic article that they felt were about themselves. You know, I must be onto something here, because it's not that often that academic researchers get kind of positive feedback from their research objects in a way, right? So this kind of response really spurred me on and supported my belief that this kind of work deserved to be recognized and represented in the scholarly literature on photography. And really scholarly literature on photography has tended to focus on photographers and maybe the outlets that immediately cater to photographers, like newspapers and magazines and stuff. So I wanted to highlight more what I call the auxiliary trades of photography. And as I was writing and rewriting the book, you know, the changes to the business really accelerated so much just in that period. And that affected my goals in some ways, during the writing of it. For example, when I first started writing, I hadn't planned to take it as far back as the 1830s before the invention of photography. But I realized, you know, by the time I came to sort of finish up, when we were about two decades into the 21st century, that readers would really need to get that much background in order to get their heads around how the picture industry came to be in the first place, you know, before they could even understand what it had been and what it has now become. There needed to be this sort of much longer, deeper history, in a sense. The goal has always been to make visible invisible work that's taken for granted, and to sort of highlight both the work that pictures do in culture and society, but maybe even more the kinds of work that pictures make us do, and the pictures are required to be done, in a way, by various kinds of often unrecognized and unheralded workers.
Yeah, definitely. And I love that anecdote of a picture librarian reaching out. I think it highlights that, you know, we often feel like there's a gap between theory and practice, for lack of a better distinction. And to bridge that gap and have a practitioner say, like, this research sees me is just, I mean, I feel like that's what we all hope for.
Yes, absolutely.
And you noted going back to the 1830s, that was such a fascinating place to start for me as a reader. So in the first and second chapters, you set this stage for what becomes the photo industry, looking at pre-photographic context for intellectual property rights and the early establishment of best practices for picture libraries. Could you explain some of the factors then that shaped early picture libraries and what kind of work these spaces were doing and who was doing that work?
Yes, sure. So just to give an overview, there were really three factors that together enabled the business model of the picture library. So one was the legal framework of copyright, which at least in UK law predated the invention of photography, and which specifically tied the economic value of images to their ability to be produced, reproduced. And another factor was the beat-em-up photography, which both simplified the making of copies and eventually the accumulation and storage of such copies in a kind of compressed and relatively transportable format. And the third important factor was the library as a kind of organizing principle, incorporating, you know, cataloging practices, classification systems, and finding tools, which all made it possible to search and locate and extract pictures from the large collections amassed by photographic means. So these were kind of the three factors that had to be in place, like a legal thing, a technology, and a practice, a field of practice, information management practice. Now, printed reproduction has always required the collaboration of several people. You had to have somebody to create the visual content, as we call it now, the original image. Somebody had to transfer that content onto a surface that could be then used for printing. Somebody had to run the printing press, and somebody had to distribute the resulting printed commodities. And the early copyright laws in the UK, which were collectively termed the Engravers Acts, were based on, and they kind of reflect, the name reflects this, that it was based on the principle that all these intermediaries between the original image created by an artist or draftsman and the public who viewed and bought popular prints, all these intermediaries were really the ones who added the most value to the resulting commodity, either by having specific skills or not least by having invested in tools and machinery for making reproductions. And so all these intermediaries were deserving of compensation, and the kind of exploitable value in a picture was dependent on it existing in a format that could be reproduced and made into a commodity. And photographers, for their part, they strove throughout the second half of the 19th century to have their rights as creators recognized in law. And this recognition was achieved gradually. But for picture libraries, I guess the most significant piece of legislation was the 1956 Copyright Act in the UK, which granted photographs 50 years protection from the date of publication. And that was regardless of whether the photograph had been taken, because it was really... And it was regardless of that, and also regardless of whether it was an original photograph or a reproduction of another picture. And so that was useful for picture libraries, both those who specialized in reproductions of older works, so re-photographing old master artworks, for example, works that were in the public domain, and they can then claim copyright in the reproductions for 50 years from whenever they might be used in a publication. So not from the date that they took the picture, re-photographed the work, but actually from whenever it was first published, that photograph. And then it was also useful for the archives of newspapers, which I think in North America tend to be called the morgues,
yeah,
quite evocatively. And so newspapers and periodicals who commissioned photographs for publication, they could then keep the overs, as we'd call them in the business, so the leftover photographs from commissioned shoots, they could keep them on file and then exploit them for illustration purposes at a later date. I mean, they could also resell the ones that had been used, but particularly these overs that hadn't been published before could, you know, have a much longer shelf life in a way, because the copyright didn't start until they were first published. And then, of course, it's one thing to have all these pictures and to have the right to exploit them. But it's quite another thing to manage huge collections of pictures and, you know, find efficient ways of locating relevant pictures for whatever purpose those who are willing to pay for them might need them. And so that's really where the skills and systems of archiving and librarianship come in, to produce that kind of rather unique institution that a picture library is, or maybe we should say was. And so those institutions, you know, were created to serve different kinds of clients, audiences, usually from publishing, advertising, and the press. So people who needed pictures to illustrate all kinds of concepts or events or objects or and people, and who quite often couldn't or weren't able to, you know, or didn't want to spend money on commissioning new photographs of them. And then they were often staffed by women, and particularly in sort of after the Second World War, picture librarianship was really one area where women could make a kind of quite good professional career in a sort of creative capacity. And I think that was maybe, you know, I sort of go into that a bit in the book, that it was partly because it was seen to be a sort of clerical job. So, you know, working in the archive or in the picture library was seen to be a sort of a filing job, you know, sort of the sort of thing that women's work in that sort of sense. But in fact, even though it did involve a lot of filing, it was also quite creative, you know, because you had to have a lot of general knowledge, and you learned a lot just from browsing the stacks and the files and looking at pictures and reading about them. And you had to know a lot of things, know where to start looking for something that might illustrate a concept, and things like that. So that's another kind of characteristics of picture libraries, particularly in the, well, I think, throughout the period when they were kind of big business, but particularly in the sort of early decades after the Second World War.
Yeah, that expertise that is developed by some of the like characters, I guess, that you describe who are working in these spaces, it's just astonishing, the knowledge contained in individuals of exactly what is where. And I think that's something in the information professions we always deal with, like so much knowledge is in individuals and that can't be replicated. Like it can be replicated in different ways, but they're different.
Yeah. And I think, you know, every person who works in any library or archive, doesn't have to be a picture one, but I think, you know, maybe in particular in picture libraries or picture archives, develop their own sort of, we might call it a psychogeography of the space. And again, coming back to this person who phoned me up to say they felt seen in my article, you know, they said that I can be on the phone to somebody who's asking me for something, and I'll be just talking to them on the phone, and I'll start browsing in the files. And before I know it, I've got a picture that is what they want. And I'm not entirely sure how I did that. It was just like they were talking to me and explaining, and I was kind of just drifting in the general direction where I felt there was a right picture. And it sounds completely sort of mad, but I think it is often how people start inhabiting those spaces. And, you know, and he would have a colleague then who would navigate in a completely different way and have other kinds of, you know, another kind of memory palace or whatever, constructed to navigate the same library, the same archive.
Yeah, absolutely. That resonates a lot with my experience working in these spaces, and I think it speaks to like the value that we see of, having picture collections. So then moving on to your third chapter, here you focus on research, and we see a lot about intermediation here. So how the staff of picture libraries attempted to dictate good research, which was fascinating to me, good research practice, and they position themselves as these expert intermediaries. And you dive into the Picture Researcher's Handbook, which was produced by the Mary Evans Picture Library. How did you see the evolution of that handbook from the 1970s through the early 2000s as illustrating the transformation of picture libraries?
Yeah, so I just point out that it was the Picture Researcher's Handbook was made by Hilary and Mary Evans, who ran the Mary Evans Picture Library, but it wasn't kind of produced. I mean, it wasn't the Picture Library that published it, just to be clear. But yeah, that it definitely, and they didn't talk that much about their own library in the books, but obviously that's where a lot of their background comes from. So this handbook was published in 8 editions between 1975 and 2006. And it started out, it was conceived as a kind of travel guide. You know, it was supposed to be the equivalent of a travel guide. And one of those travel guides that's a bit sort of personal and subjective and gives you the kind of behind the scenes tips in addition to just the addresses and the contact details. And so the first handbook was also, first handbook was that, but it was also a sort of how-to guide. What is picture research and how do you go about doing it and what do you need to think about if you want to do it and how do you contact people, how do you address people in order to get them to do the work for you, to do the search for you, for example. And so that was quite a big book. And then as the editions went on, more and more space was given over to just the contact details. And it was less sort of information, but I guess presumably they thought that their audience by now knew how to do picture research. There were more people doing it. They had trained one generation, that generation probably trained the next generation, etc. It also changes how, because it's a book, it has to be. Again, there's this thing of how to find your way in the book as well, how to find the sort of address that you're interested in. And so it was an international guide, so it had to cover the whole world. I mean, or at least every picture library that the editors had heard about and had contact details and wanted to recommend in the world. And so it was kind of organized according to like continents at the beginning. And there was like one, that was one way of organizing it, and then there was other indexes that said this is the subject and this is, you know, there was different, so that you could start, and there were different kinds of ways that you could navigate the same book. Now that changed later. It became, I mean, at the end it's more like a sort of printed out version of the internet, to be a bit blunt, but like it was much more sort of keyword based. You could see that the way that we had started searching was from having to think about, okay, how can I get hold of this picture nearby, because that's what you had to do when you had to get the physical picture sent. It was more like, where can I get the best picture for this particular thing, because I can get it digitally, so it doesn't matter, I can get it from Nepal if that's where the right picture is, even though I need it in Oslo, right? So that was one of the ways that you can see the change. And also in the details provided about the library. So to begin with, it was just the address, the street address, postal address, and phone number. And you were advised to write beforehand and state what you wanted, and then maybe follow up with a call or go in person. That was stressed a lot, that the best thing was to go in person and do the search in person yourself. Not just because you couldn't trust the people who weren't there to find the stuff you wanted, but also because that was a way of getting to know the collection in that way that we just talked about, like finding your own sort of getting a grip and like getting an image in your head about what is it, the stuff that they have. I know I'm looking for this kind of thing, but if I'm looking at that drawer where they have pictures of, I'm going to say dachshunds because that's the first thing that came into my mind. Maybe in the next drawer, because of whatever idiosyncratic classifying system they have, they also have pictures of food. And there's like a dachshund sausage connection that somebody there had, you know, put in. And now I know that they also have a great food collection, which I wouldn't have found out otherwise, because I was looking for this pictures for the book about dogs, right? So that sort of practice, I mean, they were very sort of encouraging of that sort of practice in the earlier. I mean, no, actually, they were doing that throughout the time, but as the time wore on, it was more like, okay, we know you're doing it through a screen now. So, you know, we're not going to tell you too much about going straight to the libraries. But yeah, so the advice on how to approach libraries and how to conduct searches and you know, really how, yeah, the practicalities of how the work tell from the successive editions, how that changed. And also, because they wrote an introduction to all of the editions, you can also see their own experiences and their thoughts and their, not least, expectations for the business change. You know, sometimes they'll be like, in the early 1990s, thinking, oh, it must be a matter of time before we can get all the pictures electronically. And then next time they're like, oh, actually, no, it's the fax. That's the thing that's really changed. Now, you know, and there's a sort of that they, every time they kind of reflect on whatever new technology has happened since the last edition and how that's changed the business. And then eventually, and then in the final one, they kind of got to the point where they prophesied maybe 15 years earlier about instant electronic transmission of pictures. But yeah, that's it is really interesting to see how like each edition has a sort of one new major technological event that's transformed the business since the last.
Yeah, and that's what you mentioned about how some of their writing changed based on just what they knew about how people were doing research, I think is so interesting because it does highlight these issues of like changing user behavior in terms of how people rely on browsing physical collections or not. It was amazing to, you know, begin having access online to things, but it maybe put a damper on other behaviors that had other benefits, like you mentioned, finding unexpected connections in drawers that are side by side.
Yeah, and also meeting people and talking to the people who worked there, talk to people who knew the collection, you know. And one of the people I interviewed, you know, said, oh, I miss the endless cups of tea. You know, I miss kind of. And also the same person actually, I think, said in a different kind of context, well, you know, I was thin in those days because I was running around all the time. So when I was younger and I was starting out, I was running out all over London. I was having to go places and carry stuff all the time. And I was thin. And now I just sit at home in my computer or I sit at a client's office and, you know, I don't go anywhere. And I sit there and kind of complain about the slow broadband access or, you know, something like that. That's what the work is now, you know.
Yeah, that's a really like vivid example of the change. So then as digitization hit the scene, what are the different ways that digital tools and possibilities were incorporated into these picture libraries, and how did this shift the intermediation work that picture libraries had traditionally performed? We've talked about that a little, but I'm thinking specifically of some of the ideas you dig into in chapters 5 and 6 regarding shifts in what labor is being performed and by whom. So I was wondering if you could describe for listeners what kind of changes were happening and also what source material you found this in as you were doing your research.
Yeah, so you know, one of the main thing, I mean, this is something that happened really quite sort of overnight between sort of 2000, 2001, was that two very big platforms, Corbis Images and Getty Images, kind of, they didn't take over the business, but they brought their online content to such a critical mass, and the search engine capabilities, you know, became, I wouldn't say great or good, but kind of they were at that level where, you know, people found that, oh, actually, you know, I can do so much work just from my own desk now. Like it's much more efficient, and they do have a lot because these platforms, you know, acquired a lot of both niche picture libraries and large collections. There'd always been large general collections, but they kind of acquired a lot of all kinds of pictures. So suddenly you didn't have to do, you know, a sort of high street shopping trip going into every single specialist shop in order to get photographs for a project. You could just go into this one big superstore, online superstore, and find everything from your sort of artisanal bread to, you know, cheap, I don't know, detergent or something, right? A picture equivalent of that. And that really meant that everybody else had to do something. So a lot of people have been sitting back thinking, oh, you know, not maybe not this internet thing is going to blow over, but more like we can't afford to invest in digitizing because it's really expensive. But a lot of them then had to do something. They had to get online and they had to provide some sort of search and delivery. And a lot of them were able to do that quite quickly because they did have really good, you know, metadata already because they were libraries. So they had lots of information in text form. A lot of them had already computerized their catalogs, just like libraries did, you know, the 1970s. So they had lots of information about their images, even if they didn't have that many images online. But then they also had the images stored in convenient formats for digitization. So 35 millimeter transparencies, for example, were quite quick to just scan low resolution versions that you can get a thumbnail up online without it costing too much. And then clients could kind of get an idea of, okay, this picture is of something like that. And then they could happily wait to get the high res. And this is what the Mary Emmons Picture Library, which is in the main case study, in parts of the book, this is what they did. Even though they were independent, they didn't have a lot of funding. They had to do everything kind of, you know, they had to really cut their, what's it called? Cut their coat to suit their cloth or something. but they were able to do that because they had all this, the systems in place. And then, you know, because I guess the thing is, they, like most picture libraries at that time, they found that the precedent that had been set by Getty and Corbis meant that people just expected that level of service, and you had to have something like that to deliver. So, you know, that's one of the effects of the platformization, was that they both created demand. I mean, they provided the digitized content and then also created the demand for more digitized content. And so that was maybe, you know, that's a really big thing that happened in the sort of early, around 2000. And then, of course, all this digitization work had to be done by somebody. And so large firms or platforms were able to, you know, do this in a kind of industrial capacity. And, you know, there were sort of digitizing plants set up that could kind of mass produce digitized copies, and other people had to do it more in a sort of cottage industry way of just, yeah, doing it as part of their daily work. That's really, you know, that work's still going on. And so in the final chapter, I sort of contrast two approaches to this. And then one is from Getty, which in I think, when was it? 2011. They did a sort of, you know, sort of self-promotory kind of picture series of digitization and other kinds of picture library work going on in the Getty archive, where, you know, professionals are engaged in digitizing historical pictures and kind of, you know, both production and post-production and doing it using all the, you know, modern bells and whistles of digitization. And then the other example there is the University Museum of my university, which has to rely on work to welfare people or volunteers to digitize because they can't afford to pay people to do it. You know, they have to, so they end up having sort of 3-week stints, people coming in and then just learning how to do it and then leaving again. And then they have to, so that's a completely different different kind of labor force and different kind of what's the word I want? Workflow.
Yeah, that photo series from Getty that you describe and really analyzed was so fascinating to me, because as you said, it is fairly promotional, but also looking at it from just an informational angle of seeing who they choose, what tasks they choose to depict in the process, and how they depict those, who is in the picture. I thought that like your use of that as source material was really instructive for how we can look at different kinds of things to learn how labor is changing and how intermediaries are changing.
And I think also, you know, that there's a lot, you know, just, and I think that it kind of correlates. I mean, in chapter two, I also have this, again, this is a promotional picture from a picture library in 1951 of showing off, you know, the staff at work in the picture library, kind of filing and looking at paper prints. And it shows how the work has changed, but that is still skilled work going on, you know? And it's maybe also a bit sort of obscure work, or sort of work that you wouldn't know about it unless you were told about it, unless you were doing it yourself. But, you know, with kind of 60 years in between, they still, found it worth, maybe we do it more now because it's so easy to do it. But I think, you know, on the whole, people document how they work too little. They should be doing it more.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's interesting to think of an organization doing that documentation as opposed to individuals documenting their own work, which maybe happens a little more.
I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they probably didn't do that much in the 1950s.
No.
Because they, you know, I mean, they probably did do some snaps at, you know, office parties and stuff, but probably not that much. But yeah. But, you know, there's also, I mean, another kind of work, of course, that came in that, you know, some of the people I interview talk about is this work of tech support, you know, that, you know, one of the people I interviewed said, well, you know, when everything's digitized, you don't need picture librarians anymore because it'll be like the telephone exchange. You only need some people when something goes wrong. So you only need, you know, some kind of tech support for when the download fails or whatever, right? But of course, that also, you know, other people found that but they can't necessarily help me with what I need because they can help maybe the download pipe, as it were, but they may not be able to help me find a picture that I maybe know is in the archive, but I can't find it online. I remember sort of this from my own experience, I guess in the early 2000s, when there was a sort of black hole in the holdings of particularly the sort of news agencies. They had some really old archival stuff that they digitized. And then of course they had everything that had been done since press photography was digitized, which happened in the course of the 90s, so a bit earlier than the rest of the stock photography business. I remember sort of phoning up to ask about stuff that was from the 1980s. Like, remember sort of, you know, demonstrations against apartheid in South Africa and that kind of stuff. They didn't have it because they hadn't digitized it. It wasn't interesting enough and it wasn't old enough for them to digitize it, but it wasn't new enough to be digital. So it was like, no, we don't have that. And I was like, well, obviously you do, because you were a news agency in the 1980s. So you must have done this. But you know, for the purposes of the people who were at work, no, they didn't have it because they didn't know where to look in the archives for it. You know, they just knew how to kind of send the stuff that was already digitized.
Yeah.
So that was a different kind of, you know, that was sort of, I mean, I'm sure that's changed now. We're probably caught up on digitizing. But that's an example of how, you know, those kind of, you got rid of some kind of, some sorts of staff, and then you replace them with people who had different skills, but there was then left a sort of gap where the old skills used to be and the new skills didn't cover. Yet, anyway.
Definitely. Yeah. And I mean, those decisions of like what skills to continue valuing and what things to digitize, I mean, they do feel a bit political, which leads me to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, something you wrote in the introduction of your book. You noted that the digitization imperative appears both ahistorical and apolitical, when it is, of course, a phenomenon tied to a particular historical moment and a particular kind of politics. I found that statement very thought-provoking, and I was wondering if you could highlight for listeners the kind of politics that you see influencing the shift in picture libraries towards this digitization imperative. And I'm thinking about how we might watch for those similar political influences broadly in fields of digitization and collection management.
Yes, and I think that's probably, I probably had collection management more in mind when I wrote that than picture libraries, because for picture libraries, I guess it's political in the sense that it's economic, you know, imperative. You know, if you want to survive, you need to have stuff digitized. So that's, possibly got a political economy aspect of it. But really, I think the political aspect really comes in terms of collection management, you know, museum collection and library collection management in particular, archives too. And I think, again, it's this thing that, I mean, what I talk about in the book, when I sort of coined this term, post-digitization, which I call, you know, this sort of expectation that everything is already digitized. And if it hasn't been, then there's a mistake, and it should be digitized immediately. A bit like me, you know, moaning at this person in the early 2000s that they didn't have anything digitized from the 1980s. You know, like, well, it should be. Get on it, you know. And that's that attitude is also held by politicians or people who make decisions that are political. Let's just say, and you know, thinking in particular about the place that I live in Norway is a very is a country where there's a lot of urban-rural tension. Or you know, it's a country that is very much a sort of the idea of democratization is very much bound up in people living where they want to live and not having to go into a town to do what they want to do and that sort of stuff. So, digitizing museum collections in order to enable people to sit wherever they like and have access to all the cultural heritage that they are paying for is very strong, right? So that's one example of how that digitization imperative works, that this is what the taxpayer should have because it's what they've been paying for. And I think, you know, an example from academia would be something like Art Store, which, you know, was a sort of political, in a sense, response to the shift that was happening, that, you know, art historians teaching courses realized, well, we can't just be doing with these slides anymore. That's clearly going the way of all flesh. We need to digitize collections. And rather than every single tiny college digitizing their own slide library, maybe it would make sense for somebody to kind of do a big, that has a big collection to sort of share their take on the burden and kind of be the Getty Images or Corbis Images of art history teaching and provide that for everybody else. And then of course that generates pressure on others to either join that initiative and start using it or to create their own alternatives, because it becomes, you know, an industry standard or, you know, a general creates that expectation that then, like it or not, you have to live up to if you're going to keep going in that field, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
not sure
also,
if that's what you were expecting me to say, but.
No, definitely. I mean, you're making me also think about how that digitization imperative played out in the last few years. While there was a pandemic and many of us could not get to our institutions to look at collections, and there were a lot of conversations about, well, obviously digital is the most accessible. Obviously digital is like the way we should be learning to teach. And I think that there are incredible access and education opportunities in digitization, but then that makes an assumption that other types of use, other types of access are not good at all. And I don't think that we can make that black and white distinction.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, I mean, my project sort of originates in I guess at a moment, which we tend to talk about as the material turn in photography studies, which I think was a little bit spurred on by that early digitization imperative, when, you know, it was becoming accepted to just, you know, pictures were being digitized, photographs were being digitized, and that was fine. And we could just see them online now. And then a lot of people were saying, well, hang on, there's a lot of, you know, a printed photograph has a lot of qualities that don't come across on a screen, and that are worth, that tell you something about that picture. And so that sort of, you know, a lot of people in photography studies in particular would say that, oh no, digital is just, is not good. You know, that's not the thing we should be aiming for. That's a really bad surrogate. I think, you know, now it's probably more like we accept that it has lots of great uses, but maybe not those uses that we maybe not necessarily, you know, digitizing everything. I mean, one example is, you know, that we're now recording this using a platform that allows us to see each other as we're speaking. And I've seen a lot of libraries recently offer, or archives also offering people to have, instead of coming to the library, if they need to see, like, you know, a volume of a book that's rare, a rare book of some sort. Let's say I needed to look at something that was in a US library, and I hate traveling transatlantically. I'm really so scared of flying. So it'd be great if I could, you know, if it was in your library, I could get you to set up a Zoom call and you could kind of flick through it for me, and you can tell me, and you can say, you know, I wouldn't be able to smell it, but I'd be able to see a lot, and you'd be able to tell me a lot, and I could ask you stuff while you were looking at it. And so that sort of, you know, that kind of use of digital technology is not maybe what the sort of digitization projects have in mind, and certainly not the digitization project managers have in mind, but that might be really, you know, a very helpful and, you know, I would say on low tech or slightly quite low cost version of a way of using these digital technologies, you know, in, I guess, in ways that we learned during the pandemic, because I think that's when it started. People realized, oh, we can do that. Yeah, that's helpful. Rather than necessarily digitize this whole book, we can just, the few people, let's face it, who actually need to see it, you know, they can, we can probably fit in a Zoom call with them.
Definitely. We can be more like creative and critical about how we use digital technology.
Because I think that's one of the things, one of my sort of gut feelings about digitization, you know, those large scale, in particular, publicly funded, you know, digitizing museum collection kind of thing, is that nobody came to see this stuff before. Very few people still probably want to see it. So is it worth it, you know, unless it can be done very much like in, on a sort of rote basis, that it's easier to do the whole batch rather than choose the few things to digitize, then really what is the point? You know, wouldn't it be better to do something like, yeah, offer remote access, but kind of to the ones who actually want it? But then, you know, then you might say that, well, you wouldn't come across it if it wasn't browsable online. So there's, you know,
yeah,
this is going to be, and, you know, I'll probably be engaged in these kinds of discussions until I retire, at least.
Yeah, well, enough to keep you busy. And I've taken a lot of your time, but before we wrap up, I would actually love to hear what you're working on next. And if you have new projects that grow directly out of this book or other new things that you're working on.
Yes, I do have a new project that does in many ways grow out of this book, in the sense that it's still about intermediaries. And it's sort of, I guess it was probably spurred on by that first chapter, which is about the engravers. So I'm now looking at sort of the intermediaries involved in a photomechanical reproduction of pictures. So I'm really interested in, and again, like coming back to this material turn, the actual object. So what I'm now sort of thinking about as intermediary pictures. So the sort of the stereotype and what we call in Norwegian the cliche, so the half tone, like the actual physical half tone, rather than, oh, I see this photograph reproduced in the newspaper is a half tone picture. Yeah, but like the actual printing plate thing that was made that enabled a photograph to be reproduced in print, right? So those kinds of images that were temporary, you know, they were never meant to be seen. They had a use. And the reason we have dead metaphors like cliches and stereotypes now is because those objects had, there was a cost in producing them. And that's why people kept them and then used them up. And in fact, the word stock image comes from the same thing. It comes from the stock, the bit of board that those pictures were mounted on, the metal plates were mounted on. And they were then worn out, you know. And that's sort of, so a material history of the cliche is my next project. Probably the best term for it for the moment. It's very much at a starting point. And I'm going to be focusing on the Scandinavian context for that. So all my source material is probably going to be, my main source material is going to be from Scandinavia, because there's been very little done on it as yet here. There's been quite a bit done in the UK and in North America, and I think also in France, but not so much here yet.
Well, that sounds really neat. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for this conversation. I hope what I've said isn't completely or too much at odds with what is actually in the book.
No, I feel like you gave a very, very beautiful representation of all the research that you did, and the way that you laid it out in this conversation really came across to me as how you laid it in the book. So I hope listeners will also read the book. Once again, my guest today is Nina Lager-Vestberg, author of Picture Research, available open access from MIT Press. And my name is Jen Hoyer, and you're listening to the Library Science Channel of New Books Network.